Come on with the lovely melody.
Hey folks, welcome to this week's podcast. It is Michael Shelley here with Carl Giamarese, my guest today from the Buckinghams. You know, I was playing some Buckinghams records a couple weeks ago, and I thought, like, what is the story with this band? I sort of only knew them from their big hit, Kind of a Drag, and the deeper I got into them, the more I was surprised by them. There's some crazy kind of psychedelic stuff towards the end of their period, yet their beginning is mostly these very straightforward garage band covers. But then there's kind of like crossover between the association with the vocal sound and that big horn sound is kind of very 70s sounding, but in the 60s. So interesting band. The more I got into them, the more I was interested. And I found Carl Giamarese. We'll talk to him today and get the story behind the band. I want to remind you a bunch of things coming up. Dorothy Carvello will be in the next podcast. She has written this book all about trying to be the first woman at Atlantic Records, the first female A&R executive, and she just had a terrible time. It's a very interesting book. She's next week. Starry Skies will be here, a band from Glasgow, November 17th. Ron Hicklin, king of the background singers, jingle singers, amazing body of work. Cannot wait to talk to him. Just tracked him down in Hawaii. And Dennis Dykin coming up. He'll be here to talk about the future and the past of the Smithereens. You can check the dates over at WFMU.org/Michael. Of course, all the archives are there and the list of upcoming guests too. Also, quick thank you to anyone who pledged during our fall fundraiser, who is a podcast listener. It is very much appreciated. All right, Carl Giamarese right here. Enjoy. Hey, baby, they're playing our song from the Buckinghams, and Carl Giamarese joins us on the telephone. That is such a big, wonderful 1960s sound. I'm going to assume you never get sick of hearing yourself on the radio.
Well, exactly. First of all, Michael, thanks for having me on your show. And yeah, Hey Baby is a favorite, and it's great to hear it. You know, you never get tired of that. I mean, it's amazing. I remember the first time I heard our songs on the radio, you know, going back to the 60s, middle and late 60s, and it was so exciting. And, you know, I'll be tooling around and one of our songs will come on the radio, and I still get excited. It's still a great feeling. Never get tired of hearing our songs. So
your band is very closely associated with Chicago. Is that where you're from?
Yes. Yeah. The band started, the Buckinghams started in Chicago in 1965.
But is that where you grew up?
Yeah. I grew up on what is known as the north side of the city. Some of us are from, well, most of us were all from the north part of the city. And we had one member that was a south sider, but we don't hold it against them. And, you know, but yeah, we grew up playing, you know, at the time in 65, 66, there were, you know, dances and teen hops all over the city. And we were always busy. Even when I was in high school, I was playing, you know. And so we you know, cut our teeth on playing all these different dances. And, you know, our first big break came on a TV show. We won an audition on a show called All Time Hits on WGN television. And we auditioned along with a lot of other bands, won the audition. And it was a 13-week show and a variety show. And being that it was a superstation, it actually played all around the country in different markets. You know, it was syndicated. So that was our first real break. And that was in September of 65.
So before then, were you still in high school at that point? And were you guys just kind of a garage band playing, you know, local dances and stuff?
Yeah, we were playing local dances, and I was still in high school. I was the youngest member of the Buckinghams. So I was still, in 65, I was a junior in high school. And so it was pretty incredible to have that kind of success and be still in school. And my senior year was crazy because we were really starting to play, and we were starting to get airplay on various records we made that were, you know, Midwest, just local hits and Midwest hits for us. You know, we had a couple great radio stations, WLS and WCFL, back in the day, and they were very supportive of local bands. They would put your songs on rotation, and you'd get a lot of airplay, and especially WLS at night, you could hear it across the country. And so we were getting airplay, and, you know, that was thrilling. So, yeah, I was still in school, and the guys would pick me up, say, on a Friday after school, and we would all pile in a van and drive as far away as somewhere in South Dakota and play a gig, you know, over the weekend. And then they drive me back, and I try to make it in time to get back in school on Monday morning. So it was pretty hectic at that time, you know.
Yeah.
I was struggling to just get through school and keep up with the band, because everybody else had already graduated and was out of school, out of high school, and so it made it a little easier for them. So, yeah.
Was it the Beatles that got the band started? I mean, so many bands at that time, if it wasn't for the Beatles, they literally would not exist. Was that the case with the Buckinghams?
Yeah, well, you know, us, me, along with everybody, all wanted to be a fifth Beatle, you know, and the Beatles were a major, major influence, you know. I mean, I was, I started playing a guitar when I was 13, and, you know, I was listening to Elvis records, and I was listening to instrumental groups like the Ventures, and, you know, songs like Pipeline, and learning these songs, and I also, you know, really enjoyed Roy Orbison and the Everly Brothers, you know, and I thought it was pretty cool, but I didn't think I was going to make a career out of the music business until the Beatles came along in 64, and they just really knocked me out and everybody, and it was at that point that I says, man, this is what I want to do for the rest of my life. I want to be in the music business. I want to have a band. I want to, you know, do what they're doing, and strive for that. So yeah, they were the, for me anyway, they were the major influence. And we were listening to everything at the time. I mean, we had, you know, the Buckinghams were a cover band at the time, and we were covering everything from, you know, R&B to pop. You know, we were playing James Brown and Wilson Pickett and Sam and Dave, and then a lot of groups like the Beach Boys and the, you know, whatever pop, we would just cover whatever records were on the radio at the time, you know, and that was part of our show.
Yeah, the breadth of material is quite startling. I mean, that one band would play all that. But I guess when you're a cover band, you just have a gig and you'd have to play many sets, so you'd need a lot of songs. Is that kind of how you develop such a diverse set list?
Yeah, because you would have to play, you know, at least a couple sets, but sometimes more than that. So, you know, and you didn't want to have to repeat. So, yeah, you'd learn a lot of songs. And it was a great experience and a great thing to do, because you learned a lot of different styles, and you learned, you really cut your teeth on different, because of the different records, you know, and what they were doing. And you would constantly be discovering something new, you know. And it helped a lot. And our first album that we finally had the opportunity, when we landed a record deal on a Chicago-based label, USA Records, well, we did the kind of a drag album. And there were a few original tunes on there, but there were a lot of cover tunes, you know, and our first recordings were cover tunes, you know, our first singles.
I heard that you mentioned the all-time hits television show. I mentioned that I think you guys were called the Pulsations, and that the producers of the show said, hey, why don't you guys change your name to something that's more British, and that a security guard who worked at the studio suggested the Buckinghams. Is that a true story?
Yeah, it is. You know, a lot of people thought, you know, we have a famous fountain called Buckingham Fountain in Chicago, down in Grant Park by the lake. It's beautiful. It's a beautiful, in the summertime, they have it on and it's all lit up. But that isn't, you know, we got our name. Like I said, we landed that TV show, and they didn't like the Pulsations. They didn't like our name, and they wanted to capitalize on the British invasion starting to happen, you know, like crazy. And so we became friends with a guy who worked at the TV station. He was a security guard. His name was John O'Pager. And John came up with a couple names, and one of them was the Buckinghams. And we said, wow, well, that sounds British. They wanted a British name, and we couldn't believe nobody was using it. And, you know, we searched to see if there was someone else, and there wasn't. So we started doing the TV show as the Buckinghams.
That's and, so funny.
You know, and it was, you know, 3 weeks. And, you know, we were the token rock band on the TV show. We would choose about three songs that were on the top of the charts that week, and we would perform those on the show, you know. So I don't think we were that good, but we many, many years later, the producer of the show, I think his name was Sheldon Cooper. Somebody had asked him, I saw it in an article. He says, why did you choose those guys for the TV show when all these bands? And he says, well, he says, they were the least worst.
Well, it's funny you say that, because I was going to, you know, the story goes, you're in high school, you're in this cover band who you describe as being the least worst, and then you get on a TV show and you get signed to USA Records. It makes it sound so easy. Were there a million other bands? Was there a lot of other competition? Was everybody?
Oh, yeah. There were a lot of bands, and that's kind of a joke. I mean, I thought we were pretty good, actually, for what was going on at the time, and it was a really strong vocal group, and we weren't the musicians yet that we became like we are today, but we were holding our own.
Well, let me ask you this. You mentioned you were a really strong vocal group. Whose idea was it to get harmonies so strong? Because definitely the Buckinghams are known for these kind of, you know, wall of harmonies. Was that something that just came natural to you guys? I mean, that's kind of a sophisticated.
Right. It came natural, and also what we were listening to at the time. I mean, obviously Beatle records, and we were getting the harmonies from there. And, you know, we had a lot of favorite groups, like another one was the Hollies and the Zombies, and, you know, we were listening to the British groups, and the Beach Boys had great harmonies, and so we were picking up on all that stuff too, and all that material, and that helped us. We would discover things, we would try different things in the studio, and USA, you know, USA Records, I mean, the TV show we did on All Time Hits, that's what got us the record deal with the Chicago label USA. You know, we started recording, and the first album we did was, like I said, a lot of cover material. You know, our first single was a cover of a James Brown song called I'll Go Crazy. And that was our first song I heard played on the radio. And, of course, we covered the Beatles song I Call Your Name. And that was a single also, you know. So, and we were, you know, starting to build a following. You know, we had a really strong following around Chicago. But the competition was great around, you know, there were a lot of great bands. You know, the Ides of March, the Crying Shames, the New Colony Six, the Mauds. You know, these bands were, and we it was a friendly competition. We were all kind of pushing each other. You'd hear one band play somewhere one night, and you'd hear what they were doing. And you said, well, we got to do something better than that, you know. And we, you know, so you were pushing each other. And recently we did a PBS special called The Cornerstones of Rock with all the Chicago bands. And you know, most of these bands just had Midwest hits, but they were big around Chicago. The bands I mentioned, and we closed the show, and the PBS special did so well, we turned it into a live show, and we've played with at Cornerstones. We've played maybe about 12 shows already, mostly around Chicago and the Midwest, but it's done very well.
So you mentioned you were basically a cover band in the beginning, and like you said, James Brown and the Beatles and the Zombies and the Hollies, a bunch of great songs you guys picked. But then you started to add songs, new songs, and who got those songs? Like Kind of a Drag came from this guy, Jim Holvey. I don't know who he was. Who was the first to hear those songs? Who brought them to the Buckinghams?
Well, as a group, collectively as a group, you know, we talked about it. Everything was decided as a group when we were trying to do things at the time. And we realized that we were never going to break out and have major success unless we found that song, the song, you know, the hit. And we needed original material. And none of us were songwriters at the time, so we weren't coming up with anything. So we had a manager, his name was Carl Bonifetti, and we said, hey, Carl, you got to find us. You know, we need a great song. So he knew this guy who played in a band, not just around Chicago. They were kind of a Vegas group called The Mob. They were a big horn band. And the guitar player in the group, his nickname was Jimmy Soul, and his name was Jim Holvey. And his partner, Gary Beisbeer, Jim and Gary were songwriters writing. So our manager went to his house one day, so, you know, because Jim Holvey said, I got a song I can give you guys, you know. So our manager goes over there with a reel-to-reel tape player and a microphone. And Jim had just gotten up that morning, and he picked up his guitar, and he's strumming on an electric guitar that's not even plugged in. And he's singing the song to him while Carl is recording it, you know, kind of a drag, you know, and it wasn't anything like we recorded. He kind of sang it slow and whatever. So our manager brought it back to us, and we kind of recognized there was something special about the song. You know, it just, it was a cool title. And so we got together, and at the time we used to rehearse in our parents' basements. You know, that's what we do. We would rehearse at one parent's basement until they got sick of us and threw us out. Now we go to the next parents, you know, and so forth. So anyway, we were in my house and rehearsing it, and came up with an arrangement, and our keyboard player came up with that intro, you know, that da 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 da, you know, that whole grand royal entrance to the song. I still remember working on it and my mother coming down and saying, you know, that song has got something, you know, it sounds really cool. Like, you know, I think it's a hit. So anyway, we finally went in the studio with it. And at the time, our producer, this guy, Dan Belloc, was insisting on we weren't a horn band, but he was putting horns on all our recordings, you know, in the earlier recordings, the cover tunes, we were using horns. He was a big band leader too. And we'd use his orchestra, his band, the horn guys in his band. And so, that intro, the arranger, his name was Frank Tuzinski, a trombone player. He came up with an arrangement to go along with that intro, you know, and it just made it that much bigger. And so we added the horns, recorded it, and thought it sounded great. And it took USA a couple months or longer to put it out there. I don't know why they waited so long. We thought it was great. And then when they finally released it, I mean, it really took off. I mean, we were just stunned by the success of it, you know, as you know, probably by, I think it was February of 67, it was a number one record for us.
Yeah, 2 weeks at number one. And I was curious, I looked at the Billboard charts for that week, and the top 10, your song's number one, Monkeys, I'm a Believer, Stones, Ruby Tuesday, Georgie Girl from the Seekers, The Blues Magoos, We Ain't Got Nothing Yet, Supremes, Love Is Here, Now You're Gone, Keith 98.6, Aaron Neville, Tell It Like It Is, The Beat Goes On, Sonny and Cher, and Give Me Some Love, and Spencer Davis Group. That is an amazing 9 other songs to be on top of. And it really shows just the output of that time, you know, 1967, and, you know, sort of spurred on by the Beatles, but the competition and the quality of the music is amazing. It's really, really an amazing accomplishment to have a number one at that time when the quality of music was so high. So was your mind blown? I mean, you were still a young man.
Well, when it knocked, you know, it actually knocked the Monkees, I'm a Believer, off the number one spot, you know, and took over at number one, which I used to razz Davy Jones, who was a good friend, and Mickey Dolenz. I still see him, you know. We've done shows with Mickey, and reminded them that we knocked him off the charts, you know, off the number one spot anyway. Yeah, it was pretty incredible. I mean, we were just blown away. I mean, it's just everything started happening so fast for us, you know. You know, that changed everything. I mean, to have a national, especially number one hit, you know, as you probably know, we were voted in 1967 the most listened to band in America in that year. So it was pretty incredible how things, it was overwhelming. You know, we were young guys, but, you know, it what makes it easier is when you're a group of five guys and you know, you kind of, you have each other, you know, so that helped a lot, you know, with all that traveling, because we played close to 300 dates in 67. We were on the road.
Not only that, but you guys are Ed Sullivan Show, Smothers Brothers, Jerry Lewis Show, Joey Bishop Show, American Bandstand. You know, it's a lot of work. Not every group gets along real well. Were you guys a tight unit?
Yeah, we did get along. We there was never any animosity or any fighting or infighting, and we used to, like I said, we were a real democracy, you know, as far as how we made decisions. And you know, at the time, our keyboard player Marty Greb was probably the strongest musically, so maybe we leaned on him a little bit more.
One of the things, you know, about this crazy busy time is I'm looking at your discography, and basically three albums in 1967, another one in 68, plus you say 300 gigs a year, TV shows and stuff. Not all young men would have the maturity to deal with this situation. You personally, were you able to deal with all this?
Things were going so quickly, and you didn't even have time to really think about it. I reflected on it many years later, but it was I think everyone in the group was pretty mature for their age, and you know, we had a lot of support from, you know, parents and friends, and I remember some of our friends would say, oh, you know, that changed you guys. But you know, in reality, they changed. You know, they started treating us differently, you know, and it wasn't really us. It was them. But I think we did a really good job of dealing with the success, you know, and it was, you know, overwhelming. Those were the Beatle days that a lot of times on the road, you know, it was like, Hard Day's Night. I mean, seriously, I remember being in New York City, and we were at a record store doing a signing, and the fans got just crazy. More and more kept coming, and we kept getting pushed, and it was getting scary. And we took off down the street running, and they were chasing behind us, and we ran into it was a hardware store. I remember we begged the guy to lock the door, and he did. You know,
wow.
And, you know, things like that are, we back in those days, there was a period there where you couldn't hear yourself play on stage because they were screaming, you know,
yeah,
and,
amazing.
I remember looking, Nick Fortuna is my partner now. He's the other original Buckingham that we're out on the road with, and we've been together forever. But I remember turning to my left in 67, he's the bass player, to look his direction, and these girls were like dragging him across the stage. A bunch of them were, they wound up ripping the sleeve off his coat, you know, and took off with his sleeve. I mean, it was pretty crazy. It wasn't for a real, real long time, but there was about a year there where it was pretty crazy, you know, crazy times.
You mentioned being on tour so much, and I know that you guys shared the bill with some amazing acts like Gene Pitney and Beach Boys and Sonny and Cher, Neil Diamond, The Hollies, Kinks, Yardbirds, The Who. Tell me about any memories about being on a bill with The Who, because that sounds like a great, fun time.
I have some photos of us in a locker room playing in Kansas. We were playing in Kansas City at a theater with them, and they were relatively unknown. They weren't a super group yet. I think My Generation was out, and they were starting to get a little bit of airplay, and pretty crazy guys. And Nick Fortuna, our bass player, I mentioned Nick, he became pretty good friends with Keith Moon too at the time, you know, and we were the headliner at the time, you know, because like I said, they were relatively unknown in this country, and we played the show, and we didn't realize that the part of their act was smashing all their equipment. And so they did a pretty good job of smashing the microphones. And they had to patch stuff together. We almost couldn't go on because nothing was working, you know, when they were done. And, I remember we had an interview the next day at a radio station in Kansas City. We decided to take Keith Moon. So he came with us, and they were giving away, it was a contest, they were giving away a sitar. So he wound up taking it and doing something with it, and he broke it. And they had a fit, and the program director said, "We'll never play a Who record on this station." Well, was he wrong, you know, because soon after that, they were, you know, became a giant group. And you know, we'd run into them on occasion, you know, and Nick always remembers we were staying in New York City. We were one floor below the where the Who were staying. And Keith Moon calls down on the phone, calls down to Nick, and he says, "Go to the window, look out the window." He says, "Okay." So he goes over there. Zoom, a TV goes flying out the window past his. Oh my God! I mean, that's how crazy the TV out. I mean, you know, God, can you imagine if somebody was down there standing on the sidewalk? He could have killed someone. But that, you know, it was just a crazy time, and you know, crazy stuff going on, and you know.
Let me remind folks that Carl Giamarese is our guest of the Buckinghams, of course, and folks can get information at thebuckinghams.com, and they're playing in our neighborhood on November 17th at the Bergen Pack in Inglewood with Herman's Hermits, and the 18th up at Daryl's House in Pawling, New York, and lots of dates. Just check the website for information about that. So sometime around this time, you guys meet this guy, James William Guercio, who becomes your manager. He is a really interesting guy in the history of rock, clearly a super smart guy. He was kind of a bass player, songwriter, but he evolved into kind of like a powerhouse, especially in the 70s. But around this time, was there, when you met him, was there evidence that he was kind of this very motivated guy?
Well, we knew he was motivated. We didn't know that much about him. I didn't even know he was a great bass player. He really was. You know, he played with a lot of people, and he also played bass with the Beach Boys for a while, and with Chad and Jeremy. And you know, what happened was, you know, I don't want to make this too long a story, but you know, what happened was, you know, after kind of a drag, it was the number one record. Our record contract ran out with USA, and can you imagine? They didn't have the sense to lock us up and sign us. And I mean, what better position could you be than to have the number one record in the country and no record deal, you know? Yeah. So, you know, everybody wanted to sign us, and we had fired our manager, Carl Bonifetti, at the time. And we were getting a lot of flack from a lot of Chicago people at the time because, you know, we realized we got lucky with kind of a drag, but we didn't want to become one hit wonders, and we wanted to keep it going. And we realized, you know, we needed to make a change if we were going to continue, if we were going to make that happen. So we interviewed different managers. I remember going to New York and, you know, interviewing agents. The Willard Alexander agency tried to sign us. We saw a couple other managers, and you know, one of our friends and roadies in Chicago says, "Hey, I got this guy who's a really good, doing a lot of great things, and he's really talented. His name is James William Guercio, and he was partners with another guy from L.A. They were living at Guercio was really from Chicago. He went to DePaul. He knew the guys in the group Chicago. He had been out in LA and started a management company with Gary Evans. And we were more interested in Evans at the time because Gary Evans' father was a famous agent who managed the actor Anthony Quinn. And we thought, well, that's kind of cool, you know. So those guys came into Chicago and pretty slick and from LA. And we decided to take a chance. And we didn't even know at the time that Guercio had that ability to produce, to be a producer, but he convinced us that he knew what he was doing and he could do it. So we signed with them, and it all happened so quick, and he brought us to Columbia Records. So we wound up signing with Columbia. I remember signing the contract on a plane on the way to New York to record. We were on our way there. We were going to record Don't You Care. So we went to New York, and he got us in the studio, and that's when we realized how talented he was. You know, he really knew what he was doing, and he really had a plan and an idea. And, you know, and soon after he split up his partnership with Evans, and Gary Evans tried to get us to go with him, and I don't know, we just saw the talent in Guercio. So he became our manager and producer. And, you know, he took our he took our sound, he continued that horn sound. We were known for our pop rock horn sound, and he took that to another level, I think. You know, after Kind of a Drag was a great record, but Don't You Care just had, it was just a pristine, great sounding record, and so were the others. And so, you know, he went on to produce us, and we stayed with him until things got a little just, you know, tenacious and crazy with him. And because we started to realize the importance of owning your own publishing and writing, and he was taking that from us. And we were, you know, realizing there was a lot of money to be had there. And so we had a disagreement, and eventually we split up with him, you know. But not before he produced the brunt of our hits.
You say you could have been a one-hit wonder, and it's so true. You could have, and your career really just kept going. I mean, I don't know. Is there about 7, 8, 10 top 40 hits, I would guess, from the Buckinghams?
Yeah, well, we had about seven that were top 40 charted songs altogether, and the five were in the top 10.
Did USA, you know, sometimes when a band leaves a label, they're not too motivated to pay that band, but you guys had a million selling, you know, number one hit. Did USA guys, did you guys get paid for Kind of a Drag?
Well, we got paid, but I would honestly say we didn't get paid what we should have gotten paid. I mean, we didn't. They had a lot of creative bookkeeping, and it was hard to get the money out of them. And for being a million seller, we didn't get the kind of money that we should have gotten. You know,
gotcha.
And eventually, USA sold the whole catalog to Columbia.
Gotcha.
You know,
okay, that makes
kind of a drag.
Perfect. So let's talk about the look of the band. I mean, in the 1960s, the way bands looked was so important, and the Buckinghams look kind of evolved over the years. You know, turtlenecks and Civil War outfits and kind of mod suits and stuff. Was that the band's idea? Was that pressure from the outside? How did that happen?
Well, it was our idea, but we were also going along with the trend, you know, which the look that groups were, you know, I mean, in the early days, in 65, 66, even a good part of 67, we used to dress alike, you know, on stage and in matching suits. And we used to have these suits. Our manager, Gersio, got the it was at MGM Studios, the whatever clothing period clothes department. They actually made these suits for us, and they were like Edwardian cut. And we had about four or five examples of these different suits that we would wear on stage. And that was the look, you know, and they were, you know, like tight waist jackets and flared out at the bottom and big collars, and we were ascots for shirts, you know, over our shirts, and you know, it was a look, and that's the way, you know, we'd have a wardrobe, where we'd carry this wardrobe, you know, a big wardrobe case with us on the road, and you know, some of the suits were pinstriped, and they were just different. The ones we wore on the Ed Sullivan Show were suits, but they were Nehru jackets. You know, they had the Nehru collar, and they were long coats. You know, the coats like went down to our knees, and they were like a tan color, and that was our look for that. But then, you know, by the end of 67, bands stopped wearing suits look alike, you know, on stage, and everybody started dressing different. But I don't know if it was by accident or intentionally, but we always still looked like we belonged in the same band. And there was a famous clothing store in Chicago called The Man at Ease. And they were cutting edge. They'd bring in all the latest fashions from Carnaby Street. And so the owner of the store, who we knew, when a new shipment would come in, he would call us, and we'd go there before the store opened. And we would pick out what we wanted. And so we had quite a array of different outfits, and, you know, shirts and jackets and you know, different kinds of pants and shoes and, you know. And so, you know, because we were buying this mostly from there, and we all dressed differently, but yet we looked like we belonged in the same band, you know. And it was, you know, we were all dressed very conscious of how we dressed, and, you know, we were really into it at the time. So, you know, we were, I think, a good-looking band as far as the way we would, you know, we would dress for stage. And, you know, back in those days, in 67, I remember, you know, people used to dress up just to get on a plane. I mean, it wasn't like it is today, you know. I mean, yes, we would wear absolutely suits and ties when we traveled. You know, if you look at us at all traveling, we had suits and ties on. And maybe the cut of the suit and the tie was a little different than your average person, obviously. But we would still dress up, you know, for that.
Yeah, and things have changed.
Yeah, yeah.
Let's talk about this thing I read about. There was supposed to be a Buckingham's Day in Chicago. It was canceled when it was learned that some of the band members were arrested for possession of illegal drugs. Now, when you think of the Buckinghams, you don't think of like a psychedelic era band. Although, if you listen to the last couple of records, it's definitely the music is getting much more psychedelic. There's some, you know, fuzz boxes and things coming in, and some kind of your guitar playing is definitely getting much more front and center in some of the tracks. But were you guys like real partiers?
Well, I can't talk about our drug. No, I'm just kidding. there really wasn't. We weren't a drug band. We weren't into doing drugs and everything, and we smoked a little pot, you know. As a matter of fact, I didn't even smoke pot. I wasn't even into it, you know. But you know, some of the guys would, you know, like in 68 would smoke a little pot, and I don't think the way the music changed wasn't influenced by drugs. It was the time, the trend at the time. Things were changing, and we were trying to change with it, you know, and do things that were different. Because when we did the album Portraits, which I think is our masterpiece album, it's a concept album, and I did a lot of guitar playing on that, you know, using different fuzz tones and different sounds, and it's a lot of guitar. You know, I was really happy to be able to, you know, because the hits were really not guitar songs. You know, they were, the backing was, you know, bass, drums, piano, some organ, a little bit of acoustic guitar in the background, you know, and then you had all the vocals on top of that with the horns. Or horns and strings, you know, for the sweetening, you know. So that album let us expand and do it, but it wasn't really influenced by drugs. It was influenced by what was going on at the time. You know, Sgt. Pepper had just come out, and it was just a big influence on us. But it's a funny thing. We were in Okoboji, Iowa, playing, and we got busted for pot. You know, what happened was a couple of roadies had left a joint in the room when we played there, I don't know, 6 months before or whatever. So the police were waiting for us, and they actually broke in our hotel rooms and arrested some of the guys. I didn't get arrested. A couple of the band members did, but a few of us didn't, you know. And then the whole thing got thrown out of court because they didn't have adequate search warrants and so forth. But, you know, back in those days, in 1968, that was a big deal. You know, now Nobody pays attention to pot and what's going on with
it's legal now. Yeah.
It's legal and everything. But it was just a little bit of pot. But it hit the wires, and everybody found out, and it made us look really bad. And we had an image at the time, I think, of being like a really good guys and a wholesome band, and then, you know, to have that come out was not good for us. And but, you know, it kind of went away, and we went on playing. And I remember our band now, it's been a long time now, about 10 years ago, we were in that part of Iowa, Okoboji, Iowa, and as a joke, I had a couple of the police from the police department in Okoboji, we took a picture in front of the sign that said Okoboji, Iowa, with handcuffs, you know, and the police officers, you know, just as a joke. And But, it was no big thing. But, you know, the music scene was changing a lot. And, by the end of 68, I mean, it just seems like it went from AM to FM in about 2 months. Mm. And a lot of the pop bands were kind of being left out of, you know, it's just groups like us and Gary Puckett and the Turtles and so forth. And even the Beach Boys, you know, it was going to a heavier, more concept albums and a heavier sound with Cream and Jimi Hendrix. And it was just a big change in the whole music scene, you know, at that time.
You know, I you guys broke up in 1970, and you mentioned, you know, that William Guercio ends up working with Chicago. And to me, like, I hear, especially in those last albums of yours, a sound that would have been very much at home in the 70s if you had found the right song, you know, that kind of
right.
The horns. Yeah, and it's too bad you guys didn't sort of just get to continue it to work into the 70s.
I'm convinced today if we would have stayed with Guercio, we would have had a few more hits.
Yeah, I think so.
And I'm the only, you know, there was a lot of bitterness in the band toward Guercio. And I have to honestly say I'm the only person, I'm not bitter. I don't condone what he did. He should have been looking out for us more and that business with the publishing. And no, he was wrong. But you know what? At this point, I mean, it's like I still talk to him, you know, him and I still converse. And I look at it like, you know, I've been in the music business and the Buckinghams now since we came back in 1980, have been going strong ever since. And it's been a great career. And I can't be bitter about it. I've never had to work a real job in my life. I've always been in the music business. Well, that's a real job. But I mean, you know what I mean? It's a career. It's a career, and I've never had to do anything else, so I can't be too upset or bitter about it. But Guercio was a talented guy, and we created this horn sound. Just to go back a little bit, you know, I mentioned going back to kind of a drag. This guy Frank Tyczynski arranged it, and he was a trombone player, so the horn sound was really leaned heavy on the trombone. And like it did in kind of a drag. And then Guercio continued that sound with our records. And then you mentioned that album Portraits. Yeah, a lot of the horns and the arrangements on some of those songs remind me of early Chicago.
Yeah, I agree.
And you know, in Chicago, they were a band playing in Chicago at a club called called Barnaby's down on State Street in Chicago. And we used to go there to hear, we were friends of theirs, and we used to go there and hear them all the time. After we'd get done with the show, we'd come over and hang out, and we thought they were fantastic. They were called The Big Thing at the time. And we kept telling Guercio, you should come in. And I think a few other people were pushing him too, but we used to tell him, you got to come in and sign these guys. These guys are just great. And he finally did come in and heard them and signed them to Columbia Records, took them out to L.A., and, you know, the rest was history. I mean, he, you know, before they left him for pretty much the same reason as we left him, which had to do with publishing and writing. But I don't know how many albums he produced for them before he left. It had to be at least 12, 14 albums, you know. And so he had a lot of success with them, and they were kind of a continuation of our sound. And we even do a couple of Chicago tunes in our live show. You know, we do Make Me Smile and Does Anybody Really Know What Time It Is? And tell a little story about our relationship with them and so forth. But yeah.
So the band sort of dissolves, like you say, music is changing, and you and Dennis ended up signing to Ode, which is the label Carole King is on, and you do a lot of commercial singing, some jingle singing for a lot of brands folks would know, and you know, you're piecing together your living, and then like you say, in the 80s, things get heating up again, and you guys have just done all kinds of tours. I'm looking at your itinerary, you know, there's oldies cruises, and there's just seems like there's always something happening in the oldies moment. It's nice that you can go out and play to a room full of folks that know the words to every song and stuff like that. And like we said at the beginning, I mean, I assume it never gets old. We're going to play Kind of a Drag now. I mean, I assume it just never gets old hearing this song.
No, it never does.
One great thing about your guys is that Sundays has re-released, I think the whole catalog is in print with bonus tracks and different mixes and stuff. So folks who are curious, because I think the Buckinghams have such an interesting place, because definitely started off as kind of a Beatlesy garage band, and then adding the harmonies, and then adding the horns. So it's just it makes you guys a unique band. Let's hear kind of a drag. Carl Giammarisi, thank you so much for visiting with us today. And I want to remind folks they can go to thebuckinghams.com for information. And you guys are playing Saturday the 17th in Inglewood with Herman's Hermits, and then 18th up at Daryl's House in Pauling. Thanks for joining us. Let's, such an amazing record.
Well, Michael, thank you so much for having me on, and I appreciate it. It's always fun to talk and reminisce, and so thanks so much.
Kind of a drag when your baby don't love you. Kind of a drag when you know she's been untrue. Oh, listen. Girl, I still love you.
I still love you.
I'll always love you.
I'll always love you.
Anyway, anyway, anyway. Kind of a drag when your baby says goodbye. Kind of a drag when you feel like you wanna cry. Ooh.